Welcome to We Empower, the radio show that inspires you to embrace your potential, resilience, and strength. In these challenging times, we're here to help you unlock your power to overcome obstacles, pursue your dreams, and shape a brighter future. I'm Annabelle Tennis, your host for this empowering hour. Welcome and good morning. Welcome to another exciting episode of We Empower. I'm thrilled to have you all with us today. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired. Let's make today count. In today's episode, we'll have a great guest here to introduce. It is Sebastian Copeland, and I'm very happy to have him here because it's not normal that he is easy to get because he is very often somewhere on a hill or in a very special area but not everybody has access to. And he's an internationally renowned photographer, adventurer, and environmental activist, and who has a chance to look inside his books knows what his eyes often see. On the one hand, the beauty of the nature, but on the other hand, also the risk and the danger of that, what we humans do with it, and what is necessary, because he is often documenting the impact of climate change on polar regions. His work often bridges the gap between art and advocacy, offering a visual narrative that highlights the fragility and beauty of Earth's most vulnerable ecosystems. So I'm very happy to have him here. Welcome, Sebastian. And we start now the show with a song selected by him.
For the band, pretty eye, pirate smile, you merry music man, ballerina, you must have seen her dancing in the sand. Now she's in me, always with me, tiny dancer in my hand. Jesus freaks out in the street, handing tickets out for gone. Thank you.
Welcome here to the show, and I'm very happy that we could start with a song from Sebastian. And I didn't want to start with a song talking a little bit about it, but Tiny Dancer is really so fascinating because the lyrics were inspired by the impressions of the 1970s California, particularly the free-spirited women he observed, including his then-girlfriend and later wife, Maxine Frebelbaum, embodied the song's muse-like energy. The juxtaposition of his deeply personal inspiration with Elton John's soaring melody creates a timeless blend of wistfulness and celebration, great especially for times like this. So welcome, Sebastian, and I would like to start with a few words about you. But first, great to have you here in the show.
Thank you, Annabelle. I'm very happy to be with you.
Thank you. So a few words about you. You are an international renowned photographer, adventurer, and environmental activist. You have dedicated your career to documenting the impact of climate change on polar regions, which is very fragile, which is very powerful. But I think it needs a person, it needs a personality with a strong mind, with a very resilient personality, and with a strong vision. Because what you see is something we all don't see often, and you go especially in these regions where others try to escape from with their ideas about not losing the wishful dream of a world where everything is in order, where the nature is fully fully nice and everything is fine. And your work often bridges the gap between art and advocacy. As I said in the beginning, you create narratives that highlights the fragility of the world and, on the other hand, the beautiness, so that people feel the need to really engage in this. And your photographs have graced the pages of National Geographic and exhibited in galleries worldwide. You are also part of the Explorers Club, and you're, it's often served as a kind of wake-up call to the devastating effects of global warming. And we talked also already about your book, which is great. I have it at home, and I love it, not only because of the great pictures, but because of being thankful for this greatness we have in the nature, and knowing that it's right that I put all my power in this topic.
Well, thank you very much for these kind words. Yeah, I would make one slight distinction, and it's perhaps mostly about vernacular, but I don't really consider myself an activist as much as an advocate. It's a small distinction. I have great respect for activists who are much more active than I am in frontline circumstances. You know, my work is mostly, my background is in science as well, so it's mostly as an analyst and an advocate. I try to simply highlight the marriage between science and art to a large extent, and to try and reach that place in people's sensibilities, which is not about anger or but generating an action that's based on consciousness.
I like it very much what you say, because I mean there are words on word which are used just by, because they, people think it's chic, like activist, for example. Speaking out loud what you think is not yet an activist, and activist is something which you should use very carefully, right? And I like what you say, that, and indeed science plays a really big role in your, in that what you do. And even if some would say that you're an adventurer, it sounds like a person who is a little bit silly doing some adventures. It's not that. I mean, you do risky paths, you work risky paths, but not just because you like to do the risky things, but because you checked everything with science beforehand, and you know what path you walk. And I mean, we see that nature in itself has a superpower, which we can't guarantee to the 100%, as we saw it now with the death of Dahlmeier, the bee athlete. But I think we can be very wisely, and we can act very wisely, and we can act with a scientific manner. And I mean, you are a scientist, which makes it really good, because you know what you do.
Yes, I mean, look, I think that there are many, all roads lead to Rome, and I think it takes a village. As I said, I have, we need activists, and I am very much in support, people who are very vocal and very present. I think we all build on precedents to a large extent. What other people have done in order to inform our sensibilities, and then beyond that, it really has to do with what you're comfortable doing. And for me, I'm mostly a geek. I mean, I work in research, and then I work in the field, deep field missions. I just like to share the simple facts and the data of what comes out of it, and hopefully that does inform activism to a large extent. But I wish I were, I wish I were perhaps more active in the front lines of people who do march in streets, and I've done it on occasions, but it's not necessarily the strength of my work. But I really do admire those who do that well. Whether it's in defense of indigenous populations in the Amazonia, or obviously on issues of climate change.
How we talk about it sounds maybe for some people outside as if you are more scientist and distance to this, but the opposite it is. I mean, you are also, of course, very emotional involved in this. Otherwise, pictures like this, how you do it and prepare and produce it with your books, can't really be created. Would you like to share with us your greatest or your biggest emotional moment documenting the Arctic, a moment which you want to share with us, that we are where we can also see how much something, seeing something, being there can change a human being?
Right. So it's a great question, and obviously I've been doing this for about 35 years, and there have been many, many chapters, many events, many circumstances, many encounters, all of which, leading to this, this personal inspiration, because needless to say, the fuel of my work is for me to be inspired by the nature that, that surrounds us. And to be, to a large extent, a communicator and an amplifier of nature's voice, because I think this is what we are, at risk of losing in a world that is dominated by technology, is the fact that technology in itself, has no purpose unless it is working in communion with the world that we're inhabit, because there will be a day where technology will no longer be present, but nature always will be. And this is another way of saying that we really, really need nature in order to just exist, and in that sense, to be coexistent with it. So, my experiences, as you very justly said earlier, is really to, to bridge the gap between emotions and facts, and to try and tell the narrative of nature, which is ultimately science, because the world is essentially chemistry, biology, and physics, and that in itself could be just a sort of cold-hearted way of looking at things. And yet, the picture that it paints is this sort of, sublimation of nature, that what we see, which is so much bigger than us, and somehow it triggers, internally, a sense that we are just part of something that is just so much bigger than us, and that we're lucky to be a part of it. That is, perhaps philosophically, what I try to do. In terms of the circumstances that you've just, alluded to, what were the moments? These moments are a million a day. I mean, I specialize in polar regions, so my background is really specifically about the ice. I study the ice. I'm a polar explorer, as it were, perhaps in the old world, version of that, meaning that I spend a lot of time walking, walking on skis and covering miles. And through the course of that, the journey is both external and internal. So, I get to not just discover things that are around me, but I also get to discover how I, respond to those things and how I fit within this forum of nature. And, one of the great things about working alone, which I do a lot, is that you really get to reinvent yourself and the world that you live in. And then, of course, after that, the challenge is to come back and to try and apply those realization in a world that continues being what it is in spite of of your own internal transformation.
Is religion there a good partner in these times where you are alone? Or have you found your own spirituality to deal with situations where you are alone and get massive pictures, get confronted with a lot of nature in front of you?
Well, I mean, I think that nature in itself is a religion. I think that the sublime that we experience, and particularly, the scale of what it represents relative to who we are, which is a tiny little speck, right? I mean, if we look at, at timescales, both planetarily, but also, of course, universal. It's very, very quick that we become rather insignificant. I think nature itself could be seen in that sense as a religion. I because I'm more empirical, my background is more sort of fact-based, I guess. It's my in my nature. That I abide more to philosophies than to religion. And so, I like Buddhism. I practice Buddhism. I wouldn't call myself a Buddhist exactly, because I'm not as, my practice is much more liberal, I guess, than some of my Buddhist friends. But I do really abide by the sense that I think, that the God is within us, that we are God in many ways, and that there is something really extraordinarily beautiful about the marriage of nature and humans.
And how do you mentally prepare for this total isolation in extreme environments where you are sometimes?
It's a great question. There isn't really all that much that you can do to really prepare yourself to the more extreme end of polar travel. And what I mean by the more extreme, it's generally the winter part when it's temperatures are, very antagonistic to human life. And I don't necessarily think that there's a lot that you can do to prepare for. And this I speak of this with, I think I have 27 or 28 missions under me. And no matter how much training and preparation, mental and otherwise, when you're confronted with temperatures that are, so cold, mostly you tend to break down before you start to build yourself back up again, and it doesn't matter how many times I've been there. If you're anywhere, north of, minus 35 to 40 below in Celsius, the body simply breaks down, and the spirit is quick to follow. So, you just need guardrails to sort of keep yourself going for the first 3 or 4 days, and then progressively you start to rebuild yourself. That's the beauty of these journeys. They strip you down to the studs, and then you build yourself back anew, and then you have, if you're successful, hopefully, then you come back with this just great sense of accomplishment.
Well, thank you so much. I have further questions I would like to ask you, and I know that some exciting answers will await for us. So stay tuned. We have a small break of approximately 2 minutes, and I'm happy to talking further then.
The station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So I'm happy to continue with the talk with Sebastian Copeland, outstanding explorer, scientist, photographer, and I adore his pictures, which is much, much more than just pictures, which is a message to the people to wake up, to see the beauty, not only, but also the fragility of our nature, and see it also combined with our own nature, because we sometimes forget about it, that we are from nature, we are part of the nature. Sebastian, we talk about this before the break already. I mean, I can't imagine this because I haven't been there, but how is it seeing the melting ice, and how is it that it has maybe also changed how you communicate about climate change?
Right. So, look, I mean, there is an incontrovertible truth, which is that the world is transforming at a very rapid pace, and that we have a lot to do with it. And it is not something that is working in our favor. Shortly, of course, except for, you know, short-term gain. What I mean by that is profit is driving decisions that are literally breaking down systems, which are, you know, which are, have been, you know, relatively good to us. And, you know, we live in this sort of Goldilocks environment. You know, distance between the sun in this planetary system has been conducive to, you know, to the thriving of biology. And we are systematically breaking this down with solutions that are, you know, easily replaceable by newer, better, more sustainable ones. And I really found it, I find it astounding that we are sleepwalking through the destruction of our planet in the way that we're doing it. You know, there's a saying in my field that if you want to know where the world is going in 30 years, at least from a climate perspective, you need to look no further than the eyes, because it's a, you know, it's a visceral indicator of transformations. You can, you know, you can see it. If you see 2 degrees difference in a dry desert, it's going to be difficult to visualize it. But if you're seeing a 2 degree difference in an ice environment, the transformations are very, very clear. So, you know, for me, I'm sort of living through this age, and being, of course, you know, very, very invested in the polar world, and you know, and seeing the impacts of a longer melt cycle, of a shorter freeze cycle, its impact not just on, you know, on biology, but also on indigenous populations. And of course, you know, in a more intellectual way, understanding what the global consequences are for, you know, a multitude of systems, all of which conspire to throw off balance what has been essentially the last 11,500 years of prosperity for us, you know, from the standpoint of seasonal and farming cycles and generating, you know, calories that have sustained our growing demographics, etc. So you know, this is probably a big, you know, mouth salad here and a long statement. But what I guess I'm trying to say is that, you know, we have been very fortunate to experience the best that nature has done for us, and we are systematically destroying it and somehow allowing institutions to do it, you know, without revolting. And I think it is time to revolt against it.
Yeah. I mean, what you are expressing is something which also makes me sad every day, but on the other hand, giving me power to do what I do. And I mean, we do what we do, but what I sometimes don't understand is, I mean, these things or understanding what is happening, that we are destroying our ecosystem. I mean, somebody who has killed children, who has grandchildren, somebody who wants to look for the next generation, somebody who wants to feed himself. I mean, taking care of the environment is something super egoistic. if we take it like this, it just needs a sustainable long-term thinking. Why are the people systematically destroying their own ground of life? Is this because they don't think far? Is it because the short-term thinking is just taking over everything? Is it because they are so selfish and living now here and getting most of the power, matter what?
Right. I think all of this leads to, you know, to a simple realization, and which is that we're not as evolved as we like to think we are, right? Because if we're thinking short-term. And, you know, you used the word ego earlier, which I think is very appropriate in that sense. And, you know, it is a spirituality to a large extent, right? This kind of this communion with you know, this natural world that is enabling us to you know, to thrive. You know, and I know personally from my exchanges in nature, I always look at them as very profound communions. But the ego is you know, it's very powerful, because I think it has, you know, this ability to, you know, to supersede wisdom and certainly vision, you know, long-term vision, because short-term gain is driven by the desire to be satisfied immediately. And I think that has a lot to do with ego, you know. And what I'm really troubled with, and I have two young daughters, you know, so I look at this through the prism of what their future looks like, and God knows there's a lot to be worried about, or at least concerned, you know, with the assault on the environment, but then again the dominance of technology, which is, you know, which is driving a certain sense of obsolescence for you know, human labor, and even for things like, you know, reasoning and critical thinking. And, you know, I mean, all the discussion, of course, rightly so, is about artificial intelligence you know, and the dominance of technologies like, you know, like OpenAI and ChatGPT and the equivalent DeepSeek, etc. And it's just so quick to fall into this trap of allowing the technology to start to really dominate our existences. We saw it with social media as a primer, how all of a sudden technology was starting to really take over our need to be constantly fed with entertainment. And now, the algorithms like ChatGPT are literally informing people's decisions, life decisions. They're using them as a coach, to sort of, some teenagers are now absolutely addicted to what a ChatGPT analysis, defines in their behavior. And all of those things are really, I think, very, very alarming. And they also contribute to move us farther and farther away from simply being, outside and do what we did for thousands, come millions of years, and which is to interact with the natural world.
I completely agree with you, and you said something super important. You said, you have two kids, and the technique brings us away from the nature. It brings a distance in between this. And how, if the kids don't have a connection to the nature, how can they defend nature? How can they have a feeling why nature is so important if in their life nature has no meaning? And sometimes I'm also supporting a lot of people with migration background getting into the country. And I often ask these people, have you been in the forest? And they say, forest? No, why should I be in the forest? I want to get money. I want to have a good life. I said, yes, but forest is a part of a good life. Because if you're not supporting the forest, how do you want to have a good life? Because this is part of our ecosystem. If we have no relation to this, then how can we have an emotional base? How can we fight for something we don't know? What do you think? How can we bring this nature back more to the people's reality now, to the people's daily? I want, before I give this question completely to you, I want to give you one or share one experience with you. There was a discussion at DLD, and we said it's important to bring the people back there. They should go there. They just experience there. It should, must be a must for the people to go once a week, and the nature at least to feel, also go barefoot, experience all these connections to the nature again. And somebody said, oh, it's much easier. We have to bring nature to the people, not vice versa. And he said, what if we create a hologram of the world and of the nature, and the people can step into this hologram, and then we create also some good smell, artificial smell, and the people smell how it is, and we give them the glasses of virtual reality, and then the people can feel how it is with forest. And I was really shocked because I said, why do you need this? Why do you not just taking a ride with your bicycle, go by foot, out in the nature, just do it? Why just do taking technique for everything? I don't understand that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. To be reversing engineering nature when the nature is already so perfect, it's a very good analogy to what we had just been talking about, with respect to ego. It's not because you have the capability to do something that you necessarily should exercise, that capability. There is something which is, as you pointed out earlier, just about stepping out into, into nature, and then nature speaks, and then by this exchange, we are, more prone to actually be able to listen to nature speak, and nature speaks all the time. It's just that we are creating so much brouhaha around it that we're not capable of hearing what it's saying. And for those of us who spend a lot of attention, spend a lot of time, pay a lot of attention to what it's saying, it's not speaking, it's actually screaming. But of course, you need to have receptors in order to hear it. So I think it all comes down to leadership, Annabelle, you know, and it's not as simple as that, of course, because right now we are headed in a direction, as we alluded before the show started, where, you know, the nature of that leadership is at odds with a lot of what we're discussing here, you know, what with, you know, promoting antiquated technologies, especially energy-based, what with revisionism and sort of, you know, rewriting the nature of history and what has happened. And I think that for sure it feels like we're in a sort of retrograde motion at the moment. You know, we feel like we're moving forward, but I think the principles, the very deep principles of, you know, what it is to be human within the context of this great natural world, that relationship is definitely in retrograde at the moment.
I completely agree with you. And I mean, you sorted out as your tool of choice the camera, the eyes, which can take really special perspectives. How did the camera become your tool of choice for storytelling?
Right. So I always say that I never chose photography, that somehow photography chose me. I wouldn't necessarily be a photographer if it were not for applying that skill to the purpose of my mission. In other words, you know, I'm sure I shoot my wife and my kids, and I sort of enjoy doing that. But really, photography is a tool for communicating, you know, these greater themes of my work. And again, this sort of make, you know, the bridge between the emotions and science. So I find it a responsibility, and I take it, you know, as such, to be recording what I see, because I travel to very, very extreme latitudes and places that most people will never get a chance to see themselves. It would be a shame not to record that, and especially not to celebrate it. And photography is wonderful in that sense, because it does, you know, capture these little moments of time, and you know, and these are these little capsules that exist forever, at least, you know, for a very, very long time. And not only do they speak of what is presently, but they will eventually speak of what was, right? And so I spent a lot of time. I just came back. I was for 7 weeks in northern Greenland, and I spent a lot of time with Inuit, as it were, hunters, so indigenous populations. And I look very much at my work. It's a little more multidisciplinary at the moment. It sort of mixes, you know, the interaction of climate change with local populations and cultures and, you know, cultural identity and tradition, etc. And so there's some anthropology in it mixed with, you know, with obviously with climate observation and especially oral tradition and oral history. Of how these environments are changing. And more I've come to realize that, you know, the work that I do now, and I'm very comfortable with it, is really about informing, you know, data for 50 to 100 years from now. You know, I look at Edward Weston, for instance, who was, you know, who photographed the American Indians at the turn of the century, you know, in the teens, 1912, etc. And that was, you know, very, very important work, to record essentially a tradition that was being quickly threatened by the march of time. And in many ways, that is informing some of the work that I'm doing right now, which you know, which is based on a traditional, on a culture that is facing this onslaught of external influences, notably, you know, Western values, Western products, Wi-Fi is present even in the very northern latitudes, and with Wi-Fi comes TikTok and Instagram and Facebook and all these different social media platforms, where the world all of a sudden is kind of like split open like a, like a watermelon. You start to see everything from fast cars and palm trees and bikinis, and in places where many of these people there will probably never really have the chance to, to travel to. It's expensive. It's there's not a lot of employment up there. And so, on the other hand, of course, it's sort of like this magnet of, of wanting to draw people away from their culture. And so that's a lot of what the work I'm doing at the moment is to really to record, the indigenous populations as well, understanding how they relate to their environments, how they sustain themselves, and things of that nature.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Sebastian, for this engaging discussion and inspiring insights. And I look forward to our ongoing exchange and the impact we will continue to make together the world a better place. I would hope that our 40 minutes take a bit longer. So I think we need a series B to talk further. But for now, thank you so much for sharing these insights with us and with the audience. And very happy to hear more about you. And for everybody who's interested in the books, we will also bring these books and a link, and so that the people can access even deeper with the word you are opening for us. Thank you so much for the work you do.
Well, thank you very much, Annabelle. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. So after a small break, we continue, and looking forward to seeing you again in a couple of minutes. Thank you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So I'm happy to talk about Super Communicators with you, which is this book by Charles Duhigg. And maybe you've heard about it, maybe not, but if you haven't heard about it, you should know about it. From the very first page, super communicators grip me not with complex theory, but with profound humanity. I found myself unexpectedly in Teresa way through chapter 3. Not because it was sad, but because I saw myself and my misunderstandings and my struggles to connect and in my yearning to be truly heard. Charles Duhigg doesn't just write about communication. He holds up a mirror and gently asks, "Are you really listening?" Reading this book felt like having a deeply honest conversation with a wise friend. Duhigg weaves science, storytelling, and strategy into something that feels simultaneously intimate and empowering. I kept highlighting phrases, rereading anecdotes, and texting excerpts to people I love. This is more than a book. It's a quiet revolution against the noise and a guide toward connection that is real, kind, and effective. Whether you're navigating a difficult relationship, leading a team, raising a child, or just trying to understand yourself, Super Communicators opens the door to a more compassionate way of being with others. Doc reminds us that communication isn't about the perfect words. It's about the courage to meet each other where we are. After closing the book, I felt a little more hopeful and a lot more connected. Charles Duck is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author, best known for The Power of Habit. Born in New York, Mexico, Duck grew up surrounded by storytelling, which deeply shaped his curiosity for what drives human behavior. Before becoming an author, he reported for the New York Times on business, productivity, and human psychology, topics that eventually led him to write books blending science with human narratives. What makes Derek particularly compelling is his obsession with patterns, not just in habits, but in how we talk, argue, connect, and change. He earned his MBA from Harvard Business School, yet he writes with a warmth that transcends the academic tone. Doc's reporting is sharp, but his deeper gift is empathy. He listens. That quality shines through in all his work. His lifelong fascination with what makes people tick and how we can become more intentional in our everyday lives has helped millions rethink their routines, mindsets, and relationships. For super communicators, Doc now turns that focus inward, exploring the space between people and what allows us to bridge it. Super communicators were spawned out of his realization that even the most brilliant strategies fall flat if people aren't truly connecting. After interviewing hundreds of people from different backgrounds, couples in therapy, corporate leaders, retreat teachers, and even negotiators in conflict zones, he noticed a recurring pattern. Those who excel at life aren't just perseverant, they are deeply attuned to others. The book is deeply personal for Doc, whose own communication challenges, both as a parent and partner, nudged him to ask, why do some conversations change everything while others leave us stuck? He didn't want to write another how-to on public speaking or leadership charisma. Instead, he sought to decode what great communicators actually do that allows them to cross divides, emotional, political, relational, and leave people feeling safe and seeing them. He was particularly motivated by the state of public discourse, where polarization and misunderstanding are rampant. What if, he wondered, we could teach people to talk better, not just louder? The result is a book filled with stories that illustrate how subtle shifts in attention, empathy, and intention can radically improve the way we relate to others. True connection begins when we stop trying to win conversations and start trying to understand the people in them. So I would like to give you, from my reading, 7 tips. Identify the conversation type. Every conversation is one of 3 types: emotional, practical, or social. Knowing which one you're in changes everything. Mirror emotions, not words. Repeating someone's feelings back to them helps them feel heard on a deeper level. Ask the second question. People often reveal more after the first answer. Real connection lies in the follow-up. Use looping for understanding. Paraphrase what the other person said and ask if you got it right. This builds clarity and trust. Share vulnerability, but wisely. Opening up first often gives others permission to do the same, but timing and tone matter. Avoid hijacking the conversation. Resist turning the story into yours. Hold space instead of redirecting. And see disagreement as discovery. Rather than debating, get curious. Differences reveal deeper truths when we listen well. So these tips are some I wanted to give you, and now I would like to read from this book. In the spring of 1937, a chainster magnate named Billy Grant approached Harvard University with a proposition. Grant had dropped out of high school decades earlier, but then had gone on to make a fortune selling kitchen supplies and household wares at 25-cent stores across the nation. Now, at the age of 61, He wanted to give back to society through a large donation, and he told Harvard's administrators to achieve a secondary, more practical goal. He explained that he oversaw a growing empire and was hiring rapidly. His executives needed research, data, and scientific insights to assist them in choosing the best store managers and the smartest employers. So Grant offered to donate a small fortune to the university to fund the school's general sex research, as long as their scholars might consider his matter and offer some advice. Harvard's administrators thought the request was a bit crass, not worthy of the school's lofty academic ambitions. But a donation is a donation, and they already knew how they would use the money, so they said yes. For years, faculty and the medical school had wanted to conduct a long-term longitudinal study of, as they put it, healthy young men. In particular, they wanted to recruit hundreds of Harvard undergraduates and follow them for decades, examining such issues as the problem of nature versus nurture, connections between personality and health, whether mental and physical illnesses can be predicted, how constitutional considerations might influence career choice. The plan, essentially, was to take Grant's money and, in addition to trying to figure out what made someone good at selling spatulas, collect data on people's fitness, family, schooling, work, emotional impulses, and physical characteristics, the participants would undergo extensive on-campus medical exams and psychological interviews, and then be asked to fill out detailed surveys delivered via the mail and home visits by researchers for the rest of their lives. Once all data started rolling in, the researchers would look for patterns that explained why some participants became happy, gainfully employed, healthy adults, while others did not. The project initially was known as the Grant Study, and over the following years it slowly expanded. Eventually, a group of teens from South Boston's tenements were enrolled, and then as various participants married and had children, their spouses and offsprings were included as well. Over time, more than 2,000 men and women were poked, prodded, interviewed, and given psychiatry interviews. Today, the Harvard Study of Adult Development is one of the largest, longest, and most famous studies in its history. Among the first of the participants to be interviewed were two young men who had enrolled at Harvard in the years leading up to World War II. The first was an undergraduate who researchers developed was a neurotic hypochondriac. Gottfried Kamel, one researcher wrote not too kindly, was a disaster. He had been raised away from other families and children because his parents were pathological suspicious. Oh, when a researcher interviewed Campbell's mother, he deemed her one of the most nervous people I have ever met. And the psychologist determined that Campbell had one of the bleakest childhoods I ever seen. Campbell arrived at Harvard in 1938 and almost instantly seemed overwhelmed. He visited the infirmary regularly, complaining of so many mysterious illnesses that one physician noted in his file that this boy is turning into a regular psychoneurotic. He was skinny, physically weak, and struggled to make friends. When America entered the war, Kamel, like most Harvard men, enlisted in the military. But whereas many of his classmates were promoted to officers and returned home with ribbons and medals, Camille was still a private when he was on over discharge, with no significant accomplishments to speak of. He then attended medical school, but shortly after graduation attempted suicide, which made him an outcast in Boston's medical community. He grew so distant from his family that when his sister and mother died, he hardly mentioned their death in his follow-up stories. At age 35, he was hospitalized for 14 months for pulmonary tuberculosis. I was glad to be sick, he later told the researcher. I can go to bed for a year. The other young man from the period was different. John Marston was an exceptional student and came from a wealthy and prominent family that ran a dry goods franchise in Cleveland. Morrison also volunteered for World War II, served voluntarily, and then, rather than accede to his father's wishes to join the family businesses, he followed his passion and enrolled in the University of Chicago's law school, where he graded near the top of his class. He became a public service lawyer, got married, and eventually started a successful private practice. The grant study had been designed with the aim of objectivity. The researchers wanted to avoid guessing which of the participants were likely to soar or stumble, lest those prejudgments taint the data. But when it came to Camille and Marston, it was hard to avoid predictions. It was clear to everyone that Camille was likely to end up depressed and lonely, or perhaps dead by his own hand. Everyone had predicted he would be a loser, one researcher wrote, whereas Marston, the scientist, assumed would become a leader in his community, another chapter in his family's proud legacy. Marston, a researcher noted, is one of the more professionally successful members of the study. Then, in 1954, 16 years after it began, the study's funding ran out. Billy Grant had by now donated the equivalent of $7 billion and was frustrated that the study hadn't revealed much that was helpful about selecting store managers. Even worse, Harvard had failed to sufficiently mention his generosity when the university occasionally published studies. Grant was done shelling out money, he told administrators. The researchers scrambled to find alternative sources of funding. At one point, they convinced a collection of tobacco companies to fund the project by suggesting their work might reveal positive reasons for smoking. But eventually, that support dried up. So for the most part, the study was boxed up and stashed in the basement of the medical school. That would have been the end of the story. Except that in the early 1970s, a group of young psychiatry professors started digging through those boxes and stumbled upon the project surveys. And triggered, they began tracking down the participants, sending them new questionnaires and scheduling follow-up interviews. They expected to find that most participants had kept traveling alone, the same trajectories as when the study had ended. When they spoke to Camille and Marston, though, they discovered that assumption was completely wrong. In the intervening decades, it seems, Camille had become a different person. He was now in his 50s, married a leader in his church, and had won over Boston's medical establishment by founding a large independent clinic that specialized in allergy treatments. He was a nationally recognized expert on asthmatic patients, invited to symposiums, and interviewed on television. When researchers spoke to his daughters, who were now young adults, they called him an exemplary father, a really nice person. He could play very well, like 5 years old students. So if it comes to that, we see that, yeah, that is interesting to see about the life changes, and that if other people say something about you, it doesn't need to be right. Maybe it's a capture of the moment. And I think it's always important that you know by yourself what potential lays in you. So now today's talk and today's show comes to an end. And I hope you've taken something away for yourself. And join us again next week as we continue on this empowering journey, sharing with you stories of triumph, upliftment, and empowerment. Remember, this time is a gift for you. Don't hesitate to get involved. And your voice is valued. And together, we can make a difference. Thank you for being part of our community. And until next time, keep shining and empowering others. Together, we rise. And together, we make another way of storytelling. Every moment counts. Every path counts. Every step counts. You count in every moment you breathe. Thank you for being here.